Hey, Pistol.
Hey, Dagger.
Know what time it is?
Yeah, it's gotta be about 3 o'clock.
No, dumbass. It's time for the Pistol and Dagger Society, presented by Meltdown Comics. We hit the LA streets to fill the kitchen table seats. Our guests live really cool lives, and we ask a bunch of questions about it the entire time. And welcome to the Pistol and Dagger Society, presented by Meltdown Comics. I'm Sadie, or Dagger, and I'm sitting here with...
I'm the Pistol of the Pistol and Dagger Society, presented by Meltdown. I'm also Ken Goldstein, and
I am
this chap named Jack Dempsey, and
who are you? Go on, you got a lot of AKAs, Batman. So I'm sorry to cut you off with that one.
It's all right.
Yeah, I am the Meltdown Comics of the Pistol and Dagger Society, presented by Meltdown Comics. I'm Adam, a.k.a. Wednesday's Finest. I got an a.k.a.
Yeah, you
got
to get that Wednesday's Finest.
Hey, you're off to move out of our country here. Is Comic Book Day the same thing on Wednesday in Switzerland?
You know what? I don't know, but I will find out as soon as I get there.
What are you going to do for comic books when you're there?
You know, I may move to the digital format.
That did not work. The digital format of comics did not work.
For who?
For anybody.
Are you kidding?
Are you kidding? Who reads digital comic books?
Me?
I've actually never even heard of it.
You and
Florida. But I don't read comic books.
No, you're wrong.
To begin with.
You're wrong. The experience is fantastic.
I'm kind of bilingual on it.
Right. I mean,
half on Comixology and half on.
Yeah. I mean, here's what I do. I buy my Marvel comics, and I get the hard copy, and then it gives you a free digital download. I don't read the hard copy of the Marvel. I download it, and then I read those on the iPad or the tablet
the iPad,
or whatever. And then all the other ones, like the Image Comics or the Dark Horse or even DC, they don't give you the free download. So I read those the hard copy. So it works, and I got to tell you, it's just as enjoyable of an experience as it is.
Yeah,
I hate to say it.
Wait.
Hold on.
How the frames move. I mean, I'm
yeah.
There's
I'm
a fourth
like
voice
paper,
here.
But,
yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I have to say a couple things. Fourth voice here today is our very special guest, and he's somebody that I don't even know if you remember meeting me a decade ago in person. We actually met at a
my Lompoc or Quentin or where.
It was one of the prisons that we were both in, and. And we met, and you gifted me something so beautiful that it's in my room, and one day I believe that it's going to stop a bad guy. It was a Buck Rogers disintegrator ray, I believe, one of 500 that were made.
Right, the Steve Ford's thing, guns.
Yeah.
It was those things were an extraordinary reproduction. How did I gift that to you? I know I have
you
no
may have gifted
recollection.
It or,
maybe
or
he
I
stole
may have just
it
taken it
you.
Out of your car.
Yeah, that stuff happens routinely.
I don't quite remember how that happened exactly. I'm sorry, I took your whiskey, Sadie.
It's okay.
I don't remember how that happened, but I remember you making such a strong impression, and then the more I found out about you, the more I was like, this guy is so cool and has done so many cool things in our pop culture life over the last couple of decades. So I wanted to bring you on our show. We've been doing a show where we're interviewing a lot of musicians and talking about their lives and getting a little nerdy with them, and then suddenly we started interviewing some...
Producers and
her brother.
Will you introduce our guest, ma'am?
Damn it, sorry, okay.
And we start space people.
Introduce space our guest people. There, Pistol.
So, without further ado, Flint Dilly.
yeah.
I just found out when we were about to read.
What a cool name, by the way.
Yeah, that is
yeah,
a cool
it's
name.
Real too.
Is Dilly, is that a family name? Or
yeah,
that...
oh yeah, that's yeah, it's English actually. It's Saxon. It's like an actual Saxon.
And is there is
cool.
it Flint?
Flint
with a T.
Like lighter.
Yeah, like the G.I. Joe character.
Man, that's such a
or
you,
that.
That's even a cooler reference.
Yeah.
I might have you hold that mic if you're gonna.
Oh, okay,
it.
Yeah,
it
I'll
might
hold
be easier.
It.
Just, yeah, hold
like
it.
I'll forget to put it up next to my mouth. Nobody has ever once told me I was too soft spoken and they couldn't hear me. That's not something I've heard in this lifetime. But all right.
It's probably
Wait, is this
only
good?
Me here.
It's probably what?
Only me here.
So we, so I am so excited to have you on this because I know so much about you, and I don't know if you realize what a fan I am. But when you walked into my home here, I was like, Flint fucking Dilly's in the house. This is the coolest thing ever.
Well, this is a really cool house, by the way. You walk in, there's a recording studio in the living room.
Ish.
Boom.
And no, I mean there. I'm looking at what, six guitars or like five and a bass.
Yeah, tell our random podcast followers.
Oh, sorry.
How much stuff I have in the living
room. Well, tell them that the address is the security doesn't look too good. Sorry.
Okay. No, he actually hires security.
I don't think the window's locked on the left-hand side.
These are actually bulletproof windows, so we can do full rehearsals in here. This is one of the things I like.
Yeah, I didn't know what you were doing with those claymores and aerial denial weapons and stuff in the yard, but I don't think anybody's coming in here.
We have some BB guns in the back, some old Red Ryder guns that we shoot up, and we've got action figures hidden all over the yard that we shoot.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm going to go back a little bit because you and I are both from Illinois. You went to my rival high school, I just found out.
Yep.
So you grew up in Chicago in the 70s and 80s like I did.
Yep.
Right? And what were you doing as a kid? Were you doing comics or were you getting into music? Because I know you play some music, right?
No, I mean, I had like the absolute quintessential baby boomer childhood. I mean, I didn't really do any. I did a little bit of everything. You know, it's like an Illinois childhood. You know, you grew up and you played baseball in the summer and football in the fall and basketball in the winter and threw snowballs and
y'all got every season.
Most of my childhood was throwing stuff. You know, like every season there was something different to throw. And I read given what I went on to do in life, you know, I saw sort of the normal number of movies and, you know, I read the normal number of comic books. And like when you went to high school, you didn't do that anymore. And I played in a band, which was good. I mean, we got paid and everything, but, you know, being tone deaf and no sense of rhythm, I wasn't much of a bass player, but, you know, somehow, you know, did it. And kind of schlonged through.
Were you the Stu Sutcliffe
of the band?
Were you the Stu Sutcliffe of your band?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was kind of. You ever see that movie Sympathy for the Devil or Brian Jones? They don't even have his amplifier on. It's kind of in the end of the Brian Jones days.
Is that the one where he dies in the pool at the end or something?
No, he doesn't die in the pool at the end. But it's this very weird art damaged French film where you start out and you go all the way from Keith Richard with four chords that he's playing with the song all the way to the song we know. And then it cuts away to some weird art film by the director and then cuts back to the studio.
We need those films again.
It's
song
worth
remains
seeing.
The same.
I watched Pink Floyd and Pompeii. I mean, yeah, they just don't make stuff like that anymore.
Well, when we were growing up, you had Steve Dahl, who had just killed disco for us back in the 70s.
Yep. Remember they made it illegal? They like smashed them all in Comiskey Park.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Or was it Wrigley? I think it was Comiskey.
Well, you know, as somebody who's into music and all that kind of stuff, you have this lineage in the nerdcore culture with your grandfather who created Buck Rogers.
Yep. Yeah, that was
really.
Mic drop? Adam?
Anything? Yeah, no, I'm down.
I'll do it.
Go ahead, I'll let you talk.
No, yeah, go talk about Buck.
Yeah.
What I was going to ask is, how did he come up with the idea for Buck Rogers at that time?
Well, what's interesting about it, he owned a newspaper syndicate. And what a newspaper syndicate is it's everything that's in a newspaper every day. Like, you know, everything from horoscopes to comic strips to panels to columns to stuff like that is syndicated. It's like TV syndication, only this was back in the 20s, and so it's newspaper syndication. And he got this idea, as best I understand the story, obviously I wasn't there, I was 1929, but he had this idea that he wanted to do a continuity adventure strip. Nobody'd ever done that before. Before that, comic strips were just something that was in there, you know, four panels or one panel, and it's every day. But he wanted to do continuity. He had all these inventions, right, that he wanted to get into the comic strip. And, you know, and I get the impression he was pretty much a business guy, but this was his pet project. Because later on, there was an interesting story with William Randolph Hearst. But and he found a story called Armageddon 2419 that was written by Philip Francis Nolan. And so he bought that and brought Nolan in to do the strip. And, what remains, they're different properties in that, you know, when you think of Buck Rogers, you think of spaceships and outer space and all that. And that story is really more a post-apocalyptic Earth story. But the basic premise of it's a guy from the 20th century who wakes up in the 25th century is what came from that. He did it. It was just an experiment, kind of a media experiment. It's, can we have a story where we tell a little piece of it every day and it adds up to a whole strip? And I think it and Tarzan came out the same day and they were the first you know, adventure continuity strips ever.
Wow.
But I think this was just, he just wanted, he liked this futuristic stuff, and he wrote this whole sort of manifesto of what the stories were. And it's actually a pretty progressive thing for the 20s.
So would it be kind of like, kind of like YouTubers nowadays?
Yeah, it's like, YouTubers, except, you know, I mean, he was a corporate entity, you know, making, right. You know, it'd be like a TV syndicator.
Or the original. Okay, yeah, okay. Got it.
That's pretty cool, man. So when you were young, did that
affect you?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, not consciously, but subconsciously. Yeah, you grow up and there are ray guns all over the house and maps on the wall and pictures. Because my father still owned the syndicate at that point. And Buck Rogers is still around.
Were you a fan of that show? I think it was in the 80s, right, with Twicky?
Well, that was right. I was in film school when that went on.
Okay.
And what's really funny is at the time, I just wanted to like work on the show. And I didn't understand why nobody had any enthusiasm for having the son of the licensor running around on the set. I now, in my dotage, I understand it. But at the time, I found that very frustrating.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, I got the tour. But, you know, I just like, I'll be a gopher. I'll do anything.
I love that show.
It was really, it's one of those things where you can look at it two ways. You can look at it as, you know, it was kind of a true, you know, 70s, early 80s, you know, jiggle show, you know, network product, and it was kind of a stylish, fun show. It was, I like it a lot. What's funny is after the fact, I've gotten to know Erin Gray and Gil Gerard.
She was fantastic.
Yeah, she was just weapons grade, beautiful, and she's just great. She still is, you know. I mean, yeah, she's I like
Twicky.
Weapons grade, beautiful.
Meanie beanie beady.
That is a good one.
It's really funny. It's never come out of the box, but I have a full scale Twicky replica.
Oh.
The things just come in the mail. You know, stuff that's licensed.
Those are the hardest little figures to find. The three-inch, three-quarters.
Like the
right. No, I know. Obviously, you've got the big one. Yeah. I'm just saying for my. Right.
Hey, what do you got? Both of you guys are collectors. What do you think? I was in Target yesterday and I saw all the Star Wars stuff, and I kept thinking to myself. You know, we always say if we go back 30 years, we'd buy all the stuff that you were talking earlier about working on droids.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if you want to tell that anecdote, but.
Well, it's kind of funny. Yeah, Paul Dini and I were up working on a show. I don't know if you guys remember it, but.
Oh, yeah, Droids and
Ewoks.
Droids and Ewoks, right?
And I was the first story editor. It was a disastrous experience, but I was the first story editor on droids. And we got a complete set of the Star Wars action figures.
The originals?
And Dini and I are popping them up. Yes, we're at Lucasfilm.
Oh, okay.
No, this is 1984.
Right.
This is, you know, whatever they had sitting in their storeroom.
Wow. There's
the box with all of them. And Paul still has them, I hope. And, you know, someday, like, when we're, you know, old and broke, we'll, you know, sell them or something. But I remember we were taking them out of their boxes, and there was this little part of me thinking, we may regret this. You know, and now, yeah, I regret that. Nevertheless, the provenance of them, of like we actually got them out of the box.
Right. Well, the loose figures are still worth a lot, too, even.
So is it worth it today to like go to Target and just buy up all the Star Wars stuff?
No, because I think everybody knows now. I think the stuff that tends to be valuable is stuff that nobody at the time values.
Right.
You know, and it's like the stuff that you kind of, it's all the anomalous stuff.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's like now when everybody knows there's going to be a collector market, people collect things. What you want is you want the really rare off.
That's like why Pokemon and TY failed.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't fail. Pokemon's still going on.
Well, yeah, no, but as collectors, like who's going to buy a TY Beanie Baby?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that definitely is.
Well, the ultimate example is a comic book thing. Remember Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man
and Spawn.
You know, everybody thought their Spider-Man was worth $300,000 a copy.
The one I fell for was Death of Superman.
Yeah,
I went to the funeral 20 years ago. I marched the streets of Chicago when they had the funeral, and I got 3 copies of it.
And it's worth nothing. It's worth about the cover price right
now. Yeah, nothing you expect to be valuable.
You know, I just organized my entire comic collection because I'm moving, and I gave it to a friend to sell. I organized over 9,000 comics. The value is basically, I mean, I've got, the accumulation has a large value, but the individual issues that I thought about that I was hoping at one day might be worth something, cover price.
Yeah.
If that.
No, you got to buy that stuff just because you love it. You know?
And that's what I did. I read each comic, you know. Walking Dead is the comic now that if you would a recent comic that really just, you know, went crazy, went bananas. Yep. But that's because there's a
TV
show.
I like the TV show.
Well, that's why.
Yeah.
Because people like Sadie May love the TV show.
AMC does a great job.
So go back. So you're playing in a band in high school. And how did you end up in film stuff then?
Well, I mean, okay. So, well, I made a lot of Super 8 films in high school. We were talking about Super 8 earlier. And yeah, that was just kind of a fun thing to do. I mean, you know, you're playing in the band and you have your Super 8 camera and you're photographing that and you're blowing up all your models when you were a kid and, you know, and then editing in to make your action film and, you know, and
putting
them together and, yeah, just sort of photographing everything that you do. And I mean, I've sort of this compilation reel. I kept my high school films and it's incredible to look at. Because anything shot on Super 8 looks like an art film or something now when you watch it. It takes on a dignity that your video off your phone just doesn't have.
I'd like to just take a quick aside here, Adam, and I kind of want you guys to help me with this question because I'm guessing, Sadie, you didn't do this, but what was it about adding super glue onto a model airplane that you just spent a month building and then burning it in the front yard? What was the joy? Because I remember a lot of that growing
up.
In a weird way, it was a rite of passage. In other words, that was all your kid stuff. And now you were older. You know, it was the most valuable stuff you had.
Yeah. It must be an Illinois
thing.
Now
you got to burn it. And you knew it was on film, so you'd have it forever. I mean, you'd have it longer than you'd have the model, right? Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, I still have my aircraft carrier burning up. And I have, like, you know, they had the Godzilla, you know, the Aurora Godzilla thing. And I remember putting an Estes rocket on its back. I didn't get this on film. It was one of the best things that ever happened ever. We shot it off, and it landed in a barbecue next door. I mean, like, you know, our neighbors were having a barbecue. It's Godzilla, you know, crashing in there. Parachute didn't work, and, you know, it's on fire. And, you know, and that was the kind of stuff you could do, like, back in the 70s that now you'd be arrested for that.
Well, in the 90s, we didn't build anything. We just blew shit up.
Yeah.
In Alabama, you could buy fireworks off the side of the road.
Yeah, we could get them. They weren't legal in Illinois, but you could go to Wisconsin or somebody go to Indiana and they come back with, you know, at least, I just found black cats and zebras and stuff. M80s were like, I mean, those were scary, but, you know, it's like.
What was that one where?
Smaller stuff would blow up a model well.
We just got dynamite, M60s, water dynamite.
Well, you were in
underwater.
The South, okay? Yeah, the South, you're running around dynamite, okay? We were in, like, you know.
But what was the thing where it was like a little black tablet and you'd light it on fire and a snake would come out?
Yeah, it's called snakes. Yeah.
Those were great.
Yeah, it's snakes and you Cobra. Put sparklers in there. You know, I mean, you just do anything you could because, you know, that was our idea of special effects. And what was really funny is some of the stuff we were doing in high school that we were just making up, you know, years later, I'm working on Battle on Beyond the Stars and Roger Corman's. I'm finding their techniques were not that far from what we were. Yeah, you know, they were like the adult version of what we were figuring out in high school.
Did they use smoke bombs on set?
Yeah, I think they used smoke bombs. Yeah,
like, you know, for fog machines and stuff. That's cool.
Yeah, they had fog machines and all that. You know, but yeah, there wasn't. You know, it's like, you know, sort of back in the pre-digital film world, it was shockingly your Super 8 camera taught you well.
So what? If it wasn't your grandfather's legacy that got you into wanting to do cartoons and science fiction and all this kind of stuff?
No, I ended up in cartoons totally by accident. I mean, you know, so yeah, I went to high school and I didn't, you know, I listened to music and I played in a band and I did normal high school guy stuff. But
what was
your
band called in high school?
We'd have about 20 names, but our checks would usually come to Flint's band just because, you know, I always kind of knew the people that were paying. We were Dark Rider and Dark Forces. You know, we'd read Lord of the Rings, and so we decided that, you know, we wanted a Lord of the Rings themed name. I mean, we're kind of we pretty much played everything we could find that was heavy metal, just because, you know, we'd be really loud. You know, I mean,
you write your own stuff?
Oh yeah, I'd write songs. That was like the first writing I ever did. You know, because I mean, what's cool about it is, and I think it's still like that, is, you know, we didn't know what we couldn't do, so it's like, oh yeah, we'll write a song, and you start playing chords, and you make up words, and, you know.
That's how my first band was.
Yeah, that's how's anybody's first band. I'm sure at some point John Lennon or Paul McCartney said, "Oh, this is really song." Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, we do tend to aggrandize this fiction of bands like the Beatles, but I'm sure they had no clue what they were doing.
No, nobody has any clue what they're doing. I mean, one thing I've discovered, and working with some really brilliant people, is there is a moment, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with extremely experienced geniuses, where you just get down and nobody really knows what they're doing and they're just trying to figure it out. You know, I mean, when the creative stuff actually starts happening, you know, it was like me sitting in my rec room in high school and like, hey, let's write a song, you know. We're not doing anything else for the next 2 hours. You know, and it's just you've done it before, so you know you can do it. And
I think about that a lot when, in like, you know, Sadie and I are in the midst of doing our first full EP together as a duet.
Yeah, by the way, I heard him play. It was really good. It kind of reminded me of sort of Nashville meets Dawes is what it reminded me of.
Which is a huge compliment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it was great. I felt like I was watching, I don't know, you know, Gunnar and Scarlett, you know, doing writing a song, you know.
Would I be Gunnar?
Yeah, you'd be Gunnar in that. You look more like Avery, but I mean, yeah, you'd be Gunnar in that.
Well, so I always think about that when I think about where we're at right now with content, is that we keep thinking that there's some reason, like that the labels or the studios, that they have some sort of magic. They don't. They didn't know what they were doing in the beginning. And what's the difference? So in other words, it's
that's business.
I know, but like, there were just a couple people's 50, 60 years ago that were like, we should pay for recordings and put them out in stores. And they learned the hard way. So what's the difference with today?
Well,
you know, except that we've got the best ability now to market stuff in the history of mankind.
I mean, one of my formative experiences, I was just writing about this. I was talking on Facebook the other day and I said, you know, people were asking me questions about the old, you know, 80s cartoon days, you know, just this one window, which was kind of Dungeons and Dragons and Transformers and G.I. Joe and, you know, that whole experience. And
were you the writer on those shows?
I was the story editor. I came on as a story editor on G.I. Joe, and then I got hired as a associate producer, which means I was the L.A. guy. And then I got moved over to Transformers because I just wanted to give it a little bit more of an edge. It's kind of a younger show. So I was showrunner, what you would call now a showrunner on Transformers. And then you know, wrote the last 95 drafts of the Transformers movie, the old cartoon one, not the modern ones. And did a bunch of, you know, toy shows in that era. That was a really fun period. But at the same time, I was designing games. I met a guy named Gary Gygax, who's the guy that created Dungeons and Dragons. And, you know, so I was like learning how to design games and all that. And I'd kind of go from the Sunbow office up to the Dungeon and Dragon Mansion and design
the Dungeons and Dragons
games.
Mansion?
How do you
what was
design
that? Yeah, well, Gary
games,
moved so. Out here. Well, that was the whole point. In those days, now you can go to college. I mean, I teach classes now at USC Film School in game design and stuff like
cool.
that. But, you know, in those days, they didn't have, like, game college.
What is it, like, sketches? Like, how do you...
No, I mean, in that case, you know, D&D, tell me if this gets boring, but D&D came out of medieval miniatures games.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a game called Chainmail. I mean, the bad short version of the story was, and it's exactly what we were just talking about. You know, what these guys wanted to do is they had these little figures, and they say, how do we realistically go do a medieval battle? Well, you know, a Welsh longbowman could fire 3 arrows inside a minute, and they'd go 300 yards, so they'd shrink it all down, and they'd get rulers, and they'd say each turn is 12 seconds, and I'm making up the numbers, but, and they, you know, they just simulated it. And that turned into role-playing, you know, kind of over time. But you know, a lot of it happened quickly where all of a sudden these guys had the rules so internalized that they didn't need the pieces anymore. And there came a moment. I mean, it's a long story. But there came a moment where it's like, we don't need the pieces and let's see the game POV. And the referee of the miniatures game became the dungeon master. And his job was no longer, you know, settling arguments about whether the arrow could go an extra quarter of an inch, but it now became about, entertaining, you know, taking people through the adventure.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Monsters and People times 1,000.
Sadie has a great game that she's invented with her brothers back in the day. It's amazing.
And the kids in the neighborhood.
It's called Monsters and People.
Yeah, but I mean, when you were designing those
you
games,
were a game designer, Sadie.
Once upon
that's
a
right.
time.
Yeah, you've done it. But I mean, I used to do when I was a kid. I'd just sit there and have my toy soldiers, and eventually I had my little ruler.
Did you do anything on the movie Small Soldiers?
No, I had nothing to do with that. And that came out in exactly the era. That was the Joe
Spice
Dante
Girls,
film. Yeah.
You like that movie? I love that movie.
Yeah.
That movie was everything to me. And then Indian in the Cupboard.
Oh, yeah.
I never saw that. And that was came out of Amber.
Oh, by the way, Fievel.
Yeah.
You wrote that.
Yeah, Talking Mouse movie. Yes, Five Goes West.
You wrote that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
snap.
that was during my my screenwriter period.
I actually got into Syracuse University because I drew a picture of the Five-0 poster and said that I freehanded it, but I actually put a piece of paper
traced
over
it.
The thing. That's how I got into art school. I love that little mouse.
Outed.
Come get me, Syracuse University. Okay.
So Dungeons and Dragons, though, I mean, that's pretty crazy because that was the biggest thing.
Oh,
it still is.
Look,
right?
Dungeons and Dragons changed everything. I mean, it changed. I mean,
Hot girls playing Dungeons and Dragons now?
Why are they?
Yeah, what is that?
First of all, women are playing. Second of all, there's a whole kind of mutant game happening now, gaming happening now that's a little bit role playing and a little bit cosplay and a little bit, you know, just improv and we're in a really interesting time for media. And, you know, you have escape rooms happening now and, you know, all the lines between games and presentation and all that are just getting blurred.
I mean, Dungeons and Dragons just had a big release at Meltdown, actually, where they have a whole wall of new books. I guess they all were re-released. Is that?
Yeah, I don't know anything about what they're doing now. I mean, I am not at all current in this stuff, but I mean, I check out about, you know, AD&D, you know, second edition, you know, but there's a lot of that stuff coming back, and I would imagine they'll redo a lot of the original stuff because it was like a lot of mediums. I mean, they got it right the first time.
What do you think of the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon they had back in the 80s?
Well, it's really funny because that's when I was writing cartoons, but I was at a competing studio.
Oh, man.
That was Marvel, and I was at Ruby Spears, but I was working with Gary. And so we just sort of sit down and, you know,
So I had a quick question before we get too much further into Dungeons & Dragons today. You said the Dungeons & Dragons castle? What?
Oh, yeah. What happened was Gary moved out to L.A., I believe it was in 83. And, you know, they wanted to expand TSR and a lot of stuff was happening. And so he went and rented a mansion. It wasn't like what you would imagine a Dungeons & Dragons mansion. It wasn't some medieval thing. It was just a huge Craftsman Ranch House, but it was at the very top of Summit Ridge Road, which if you know anything about Beverly Hills, you could see the valley from one side of it and LA from the other side. It was that high up in Beverly Hills. And it was an old, you can look at it one of two ways. I love the place, but I remember one guy coming over and says, this is like a place where like some Manson murder had happened. You know, because I mean, it was a compound. And you drive through these gates, you know, and you'd have to ring the gate or, you know, the code, and then the caretakers would open it. And you went in and, straight ahead of you is just this very long, it was mostly a one-story house. Gary had a suite upstairs. It doesn't exist anymore. It's funny. A guy was going to remodel it, but he didn't see by zoning laws if you leave something up. You can leave the chimney up, but then it's just a modification. But they tore everything down, and they could never get a permit to build again. So it's just vacant property. It looks kind of weirdly haunted when you drive up there now.
Cool.
I don't know much about the behind the scenes of Dungeons & Dragons, but was it one guy that owned it and created it?
Like everything. I mean, you know, especially something as epic as Dungeons & Dragons, there were a lot of people. The two main people were Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax. And I don't know who did what. I have a pretty good guess. I never knew Dave in the day. I met him much later on at the Air Force, but I didn't know him.
At the Air Force?
In the day. Oh, the Air Force had this thing called Connections, which was basically it'd invite people from other disciplines in to discuss Air Force problems and, you know, air power issues. And it was like a week-long thing. You go to the Air War College and they put you up in, like, you know, the, you know, officers' quarters, and you get to walk around a base, and you had a fake rank, and, you know, yeah.
Everything about really cool. This guy's amazing.
It was really
like
cool.
1 week of his life, just at any moment. Just
it's a ridiculous life. But that, I do a lot of that stuff now. I've been doing projects with DARPA lately, which is the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency, which, you know, it's just kind of cool. It's just a weird career.
So, but was the guy that created Dungeons & Dragons, did he live? Is he still alive? I don't know much.
No, Gary died a few years ago. I think
was he cool?
4 years
like,
ago.
Was he like
he was great. Gary's like, yeah, I mean, he was a genius. I mean, he changed the world. And I'm not taking anything. I have no idea what, you know, where the line was between Gary and Arneson. Yeah, I have my suspicions, but I wasn't there. So for the purpose of this conversation, you know, Gary was the creator. And certainly he was the guy who took it from being something cool a bunch of, you know, geeks were doing to a major, you know, thing that everything we do in games now and since then is because of what they did. You know, nobody thought of that stuff before. Nobody thought, oh, I can take a dragon and turn it into a mathematical construct and have it fight. You know, a dragon's got an armor class and it can only blow so much fire and it's got to be X number of seconds between. You know, everything we do in, you know, you play Warcraft, you play any video, you play Uncharted. It's all stuff they figured out back then that, you know, then got a great digital sheen to it. But they really figured out how to codify this stuff. And not to mention the social component of it. I mean, the fanzines they used to have and the mail they'd send and all that. That was, you know, that grew up to be chat rooms and it's now the internet. But the whole thought pattern and social pattern behind that stuff all, you know, really came out of that era.
Well, it was your Saturday night in the 70s and 80s. It was my older brother was a dungeon master and they'd all go down. So we had all of our guitars and our recording stuff, but Steve would just clear the room, and all of his friends would gather around the pool table, and they would be done. They would play Dungeons and Dragons.
So, yeah. Is it like the sport for everybody with an imagination?
Well, this is fascinating to me because it was mathematical. I never understood it. I understood the characters you could paint. The characters are amazing. These little lead figures. Lead, right?
Right.
Great,
yeah.
Great thing.
Yeah, it's called white metal, like the Ralph Partha figures, and yeah, they call it white metal. So I don't know chemically what that is, but. Yeah, basically it's lead.
Yeah, I had those figures. I used to paint the Ninja Turtle. I mean, everything came after that. All the lead figures that they had, Marvel lead figures. They had Ninja
and that
Turtle.
Grew up to be action figures later on.
Yeah, or what Warhammer actually became, and now you see what they're doing with all these armies and everything's individually painted.
Oh, that stuff's incredible. The amount of, you know, effort people go to it, and just the sheer love and passion they put into it.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, that was something that just never existed before then.
Yeah.
There were the British figures. I remember as a very small kid.
The Britons. Remember? Oh, yeah. Well, but those were toy soldiers. Yeah, I had armies of toy soldiers. I mean, that was one. You know, that was my, you know, I think they're about, the way to understand men is there are about, five kinds of little boys. There are dinosaur kids. There are truck kids. There are robot kids. There are toy soldier kids. And there's probably one other, train kids.
Cowboy and Indian.
Yeah. Well, that's a subset of toy soldier.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Or fantasy.
And I was pure toy soldier. I mean, I had all the other stuff, but, you know, I just, our endless armies I lined up and they'd fight. And if I had a dinosaur or a robot, it was just something for my toy soldiers to fight against, you know?
Right.
I mean, it had no other purpose in life.
Yeah, no, I think I'm a little younger than you, but not much.
What about girls? There's Barbies and not Barbies?
Yeah.
There's Barbie. Well, now there's princesses, you know, which is just a huge category, you know, that Disney kind of created.
I remember. I had a princess party.
I mean, my daughter was never, I mean, she always kind of had contempt for the Disney princesses, you know.
Yeah, I cut heads off.
I used to play with the G.I. Joe figures, the 3 3/4 Hasbro figures, and they would, you know, take over my sister's dollhouse.
Oh, yeah. No, me and my little brother, anytime I got like a Barbie doll from like a step-grandparent or something for Christmas, me and Andrew would look at each other, go in the backyard, tie her up to the back of the boat, throw it in the pond, and he'd take her for a spin.
There you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, because when I was a kid, G.I. Joes were like a foot tall, and they like
that. Oh, they had the fuzzy head.
Yeah, and my mother just said, yeah, you don't want to be playing with dolls, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was just, you know, that was... And I sort of saw her point, and I said, yeah, but he's wearing a scuba suit.
I was just at the end of that, because I remember they came out with a Tarzan toy. I think it was made by the same people, and man, that was the figure I wanted, the G.I. Joe I had and the Tarzan. And then after that, they all shrunk.
Well, the other thing that happened, too, is, you know, when I think when all of us were kids, because I'm a bit older than you guys, but is you were not expected, adults did not partake in this stuff. There was a moment when you were expected to stop this stuff. Now there's no such moment. Yeah, I mean, my son and I, well, we played Uncharted 4 together. And there was zero gulf between us in our kind of interest and amusement in playing.
Sorry to interrupt, but like I'm playing Uncharted 4 right now. It is not. I always say there's three kinds of reality. There's your waking reality, your dream reality, and for me, your video game reality. But I think games like Uncharted, Tomb Raider, Last of Us, they yeah. transcend every genre.
It's, I totally agree.
To try and play these with me because they're,
see,
they're
I think
movies.
That's movies. Yeah, movies for me.
But
like,
these are actual movies. Like,
I mean, Uncharted, I sat there and it was just as happy watching it as playing it. I mean, it was beautiful. In some ways, you saw more when you're watching it. It was just like this action figure where you didn't, action movie where you didn't know what was going to happen. And what was going to happen wasn't predetermined. I mean, you might actually die. The story is linear. But, you know, you have a lot enough choices to make. Like, usually most of the major challenges are kind of three ways to do it. You know, that's the way that was the design concept. And you know, you can kind of decide, I'll do this the stealth way, I'll do the shoot my way through way, or I'll do it some combo
way. That's my way.
Yeah.
I think of video games a lot like serials. Like, you're going back to the Buck Rogers stuff. Like, I play 10 minutes of it, and then I kind of put it down. And I love that. And I love that they have chapters in video games now. So it's like reading Treasure Island.
Well, you know what's really weird when you're in a really great video game, that when you know, when you're really enjoying it and you go back in the real world and you feel like you're missing something and you realize what it is you want to be in that other world. I mean, that's you know, the word immersion is overused, but that's the purest, best sense of immersion.
And then wait till this virtual reality starts taking over, and once you put on those headsets and you're living in that world, oh boy.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is I was cynical about virtual reality. Now I'm you know, downgraded to skeptical. You know, just because at a certain point, I don't know that I really all the way to putting a bucket over my head and having no situational awareness around me and doing it. However, I did when I was traveling. I found a purpose for it. And that is, I would more happily do any tour virtually, like when you actually go into Versailles. Yeah, I don't want to stand in line. I don't want to deal with the crowds. Right. I just want the pure experience of being there, and I'm happy if it's shot, and I can look around at anything I want to, and the tour guide can go on, and I can fast forward if I'm not interested. I want the whole rest of the trip experience, but I don't necessarily need the tour experience.
It's the TiVo effect on reality.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, because I'm not sure that's what I think what virtual reality will bring you is... I mean, I think a lot of the early experiments is like every new medium that comes along tends to imitate the medium before it. Faster. And now they're trying to do real fast stuff. I don't want to be on a roller coaster in virtual reality for 30 minutes. I don't want to be in a real roller coaster for 30 minutes. You know, a 3-minute roller coaster ride is good with me, but you're going to flash the hash after 30 minutes. You know, and I don't need, you know,
flash the hash.
Yeah, throw it. Yeah, you'll vomit. You know, and.
Using that.
Yeah. That could be a good band name for you.
Flash the Hash.
Yeah.
Could be a song.
Hey, but you're actually kind of immersed in the world of augmented reality now. I mean, you were involved in the Pokemon virtual reality game.
Well, the company I'm working with, Niantic Labs, just came out with Pokemon Go today. And, you know, that's our, I guess, third product. Our first thing called Field Trip and then Ingress and now Pokemon Go. I had very, very little to do with it. But I'm going to take as much credit as I can and use it to buff my reputation as much as I can. But the truth is, I had little to do with it.
With Pokemon Go?
Yeah, with Pokemon Go. But it's a great thing. We haven't found the real name. You know, you can call it real world gaming. You can call it geomobile. You can call it augmented reality. Take your pick. I mean, the implication of augmented reality is where it's different than virtual reality is that augmented reality is you are out in the real world doing it. And what I love about augmented reality games is, because I mean, you have to, like, if you're playing Ingress, you have to go find a portal in the real world. They're all over the place in an urban area. I showed you the ones, you know, locally. But you actually have to get within 90 feet of it, and then you conquer it, and, you know, you put your shields on it. But there's actual physical object. And there's something nice about that. I mean, when I'm doing video games, you know, you're worried about pixel count, and you're worried about resolution and all that. Real world gaming, I mean, we have real weather effects out in the yard. We have, you know, real wind effects. We have, you know, stuff that you only have in reality.
So are you working? Are you free? Are you a freelancer? Can you do whatever you want? Or are you?
I'm at Niantic Labs. I'm a 0.8 employee, which means that I can do other stuff. But I'm contracted to it, and I'm an employee. I mean, they're really incredibly accommodating. We came out of Google. And now Nintendo and Alphabet and, you know, our I guess, partners. I mean, I do not trust anything I say about the business because I don't really understand it.
Did you do anything with Google Glass, or is that dead?
I think Google Glass in its old incarnation is dead. Obviously stuff like that's going. That was.
It's like I see hologram, virtual reality, and Google Glass. Like
yeah, all of that stuff. You're exactly right. All that stuff's going to merge, and I think you know how. Maybe you guys remember this, but like in the 90s, there was multimedia on CD-ROMs. And CD-ROMs were always a squid of format. You know, it just never worked right and all that. But that became the gateway. All the protocols for how you operated with them, all the way we perceived them, became Web 2.0. And I think that everything's being done in augmented reality and virtual reality is going to grow up to be something better than both of them. You know, the tech's not quite there yet. Yeah, but once it gets there, it'll be something pretty amazing. You know, and
too
so
bad we don't have Spaceman. Dang it! What was his name?
Spaceman Spiff.
Spaceman Spiff. Yeah.
So, do you consider yourself like a futurist, or are you just a creator writer? Not just.
I'm a writer, game designer, but you can't help but be a little bit of a futurist. Because you always have to look at, you know, I tend to work on a lot of mediums that are new mediums. It's just always kind of where my career's gone. You know, I was doing interactive movies in the 90s, and I was doing very early video. Oh, well, that was there's a thing called TerraTracks, and what it was a CD-ROM product. And what was cool about it was, yeah, and this is how the filmmaking, you know, how exactly what we were talking about, like, you know, you get your band together and say, hey, maybe we can write a song. Well, I'd been working on these CD interactive, basically pick-a-path adventures on CDs. And I had a thing called TerraTracks. And what it was it's like you're investigating. The idea was that if you made a 911 call and there's something paranormal happening, they'd send you to a special thing called Tracks. And there's, you know, part of the LAPD or something where it's trace, research, analyze, and exterminate. And, you know, basically they go out and find the monster and kill it. And so you're guiding, the conceit was you're guiding this officer out on the field. But remember, this is the 90s, so you're doing it over the phone. And he's telling you what he's seeing, so it's an audio experience, and you're hearing stuff attack him and all
That's
that.
So
and
cool.
And
you write those scripts?
What?
Would you write those?
Oh, scripts? I wrote the scripts and we recorded them. We did them as audio interactive discs. And you can find them on the internet. What?
That's like we'd call Santa Claus during Christmas. McDonald's gave out Santa Claus's number.
Yeah.
Yes, I loved calling Santa Claus. What happens if you call him now?
I think he probably answers. Yeah, I know the Santa Claus's number still works.
You can get like Justin Bieber to call your best friend on their birthday and sing happy birthday to them.
What? Yeah.
That good old Justin.
Would not want Justin Bieber calling my friends on their birthday.
For a horror movie.
I was at the flea market the other day and somebody left a Justin Bieber doll on an Adolf Hitler book. And I got a picture of it.
I'm surprised I haven't seen that on your Instagram.
There exist Justin Bieber dolls?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I wish his name was Beaver.
I actually found a Mark Twain doll at the flea market. I was very excited about it.
You find a lot of dolls.
Have the stuff that you've created, has a lot of it been turned into action figures and toys and products?
Oh, well, I mean, when I was working on G.I. Joe, you know, obviously it started out as action figures. Even droids, there's Princess Gorniche and Queen King Gorniche, who were characters that came out of my scripts. And
what the G.I. Joe figures?
Well, when they hired me, the pitch was, hey, we named a character after you, so you have to take the job.
Wow.
Now, I don't know whether Flint was really named after me or was some coincidence. I don't know, but I chose to believe the story.
Yeah, heck yeah.
But just a lot of stuff. I mean, sometimes you just make up a character for the script and they like it and they make a figure out of it. Larry Hama came up with most, or somebody, I think it was probably Larry Hama, but somebody back at Hasbro. Like, we would get drawings and there would be provisional names. Sometimes the names would change and sometimes
you came up with Storm Shadow. Tell me.
No. I did not come up with Storm Shadow. Storm Shadow, that sounds like pure Larry Hama, but I'm just making that up. I don't know when that happened. A lot of Transformers, you know, in the second season we came up with.
Did you come up with, who was the radio? Who was like the cassette player?
Oh, no, he was really early on. Yeah, that was Soundwave, you know, he was a boombox. Those are my favorites. Were always the ones that looked like real objects that'd be sitting in your house and transform. And he was probably the best of those.
Who did you come up with?
I don't even remember, but a lot of that. I mean, I did four shows in the Sunbow era. Okay, and I did G.I. Joe, Transformers, Inhumanoids, and Visionaries. Actually, there's another one called Muscle Machines. And I've got to remember that. I don't even know who would remember. You know, who came up with what when? I mean, right. It started out. It was all stuff that we were fed. All of the first generation stuff was stuff we were fed. But by the time we got to season three, we were just part of the creative team, you know, and somehow it just came out of the stew that was, you know, that was all of us.
Right.
You know, and so you can't, there's not a lot of ownership to say, I mean, I didn't just go sit down and say, I'm going to create a great new character today. What is funny, though, is there was a character that only existed in a script that I wrote. It was the last season of Transformers, the season three. Called Skuxoid. Okay, I'd forgotten about this guy. He was just the throwaway alien I'd made up for. But they had some kind of a contest, and they decided they wanted to make Skuxoid was the figure they wanted to make. Now, remember, all he was a construct I described in two sentences in a script. Somebody actually had to draw him. So I didn't create him at that level. What?
What was the description of him?
He was a... the third season, you know, I was like tired of the Transformers being on Earth, and the very nature of the product line is it tended to be much more space and kind of much more alien feel to it than the first two seasons. So he was like, you know, just something that looked like he was out of Guardians of the Galaxy. He would have been some alien guard who was quickly dispatched in Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, he's green and, you know, kind of squat and sort of frog looking, you know, would be the way I describe it.
Skuxoid.
Some reason people like Skuxoid. I just wanted some name that made him sound dirty and just gross.
Squidward from SpongeBob.
Because I wanted the Transformers fighting monsters and stuff like that. I was tired of just, you know, machines crashing into each other. I wanted dragons.
What is it? There's a phenomenon. Like when I go back and watch those cartoons from the 70s and 80s that I thought were so amazing. Like I just watched the whole run of Danger Mouse on my birthday, and it was something I loved growing up. There's nothing to these storylines. They were so simple, but yet I, as a kid, those characters had so much depth. Like the Transformers, watching the cartoons now, I don't see the depth as an adult. But as a child, one of those had personalities.
What you'd have to do is you'd have to watch all of them like you did when you were a kid, and then you had to have them. You know what it is like the, like I'll sit at conventions and you know people want me to sign stuff, you know, and you. You know, you want to talk to them. I mean, what do you talk to, you know, 200 people about? And so I'll be running polls on what your favorite character is. And it's never, you know, very people really don't walk up and say, oh, yeah, Optimus Prime is my favorite character. Duke and Scarlet are my favorite characters. It's always whichever one they got.
Right.
You know, it's like Power Glide.
Firefly.
You know? Yeah, it's Firefly. It's Power Glide. Or, I mean, it's kind of surprising that way.
It's childhood. It's growing up. That's when you figure out who you are, what you are.
Plus, fact, you see a lot more nuance when you're a kid. I mean, in many ways, you imprint much more. You gather much more data and process it in your own unique way a lot more.
That's why we encourage kids to make art with their hands and to play imaginary games and like run around and pretend house and pretend.
But the truth is, kids naturally do that. Adults need to do more of that stuff.
Right.
Well, that's what's scary about like the phone and everything. Like I just see kids glued to their iPad and their iPhone or their mom's iPad.
We're going through kind of a gross period right now.
But you know what? The sad thing is I was thinking about it because I have kids.
And I mean, I try to
control them with iPad and all that, which they don't have. They have to ask. So there is some control. But I was at the car wash today, and every adult that is in the waiting area is on their phone. So why wouldn't a kid want to be on the phone when they see adults constantly on the phone? You know, it's just we model that.
No, that's that's one of the, you know, obviously, you know, iPhones and stuff like that are a great advance, but we are going through an ugly period where we've got this new toy and we're addicted to it and it's getting in the way. I mean, how many really great experiences do you have on your phone? I mean, if you really, I've never played a good, except of course for Ingress, but other than that, I've never played a really great game on the phone. I mean, if I want to play a great game, I'm playing Uncharted on the screen. Or what's cool about the downside of this era is it's all kind of primitive and clunky and sort of works and is mostly distracting and we got serious addiction problems. The upside of it is we're engineering the future. You know, that's the good side of it. You know, and it's like, I taught a class at SC last semester, which at Annenberg, that was, well, I taught two classes. One was in the film school. I did that with Scott Fisher. And that was about environmental, basically environmental media or environmental gaming, right? That's everything from escape rooms to, you know, to geomobile games to just...
What do you mean escape rooms?
Oh, escape rooms? Oh, yeah, you got to try one out. So there are a bunch of them around LA. What?
I'll never do one.
Why?
They're fucking terrifying. There's no way. Life is hard enough.
Okay, the premise is this.
Do you know what this is, Adam? These escape rooms?
No. The one I went to. Okay.
I do. You have to. It's like a puzzle.
Basically, you go in the room and you have an hour to figure out the whole puzzle and escape out of the room. They're themed a number of different ways.
Do you have
like,
to pay?
I went to one. Yeah, you pay.
They're organized and
oh, they're totally organized and they have a whole room. It's like you're.
Are you a stranger?
I went with a team of guys from USC, you know, and various friends of theirs who were semi-professional. I think we either beat the record by the minute a minute or lost the record by a minute through none of my doing. So these were a bunch of Mensa guys who've done 100 escape rooms and. And this, you know, so it was, this was not a normal experience, but they have horror themed ones where, you know, they have actors dressed as zombies that are crashing at the door and you've got to like, scary. You know, stop them from getting
that. This is an exceptional segue into somebody
escaping
right now.
I'm actually,
oh, you've got to escape to, Switzerland.
Switzerland.
This
yes.
is secretly, well, we're going to continue doing our shows with you.
Yes. And you're going to continue this show. Right now.
Yes.
But I actually have to leave because I have to go get ready to catch a plane.
Call us and put you on speakerphone like it's going to be when you're in Switzerland.
Oh. Anyway.
We got to figure that out.
It's going to be fun, but I just wanted to say thank you, Trent, Flint.
Trent, why do it again?
Flint.
I'll cut it out.
Jesus, sorry.
It's fine. People call me Frank.
Well, I don't know why I said Trent.
You have a lot of stuff. You have a weird name.
Yeah. No, thank you, Flint, for coming in. I really appreciate it. Sadie, it's been amazing to work with you. Ken, it's been fantastic. I know that we'll do this again, but in person it won't be for a long, long while. So
yeah, because we're gonna tour out there real soon.
I need to drop the mic.
You should drop it, but not too far.
I'm just gonna.
You gotta drop it.
It's gotta be like you gotta hear it. Okay, they gotta hear it.
All right. I love you guys.
Love you too, man. We're gonna take a quick pause.
Hey.
Great meeting you here.
Hey,
I'd get up, but I'll knock over the microphone and spill the booze and break the haunted cup. And
thank you, Sadie.
Thanks for coming for the last
great meeting you.
Hey, man, thank you.
Yeah, I know it's fun. Well, good luck in Switzerland.
Yeah, man, you sound. I'm listening to you, and I can just tell that, like, this is something up your alley. You know,
yeah.
New things.
Oh, it's the whole idea of, I'm the world's worst traveler. Yeah. Like, the idea, I'd be horrified at what you're doing, but it sounds really cool.
Yeah, it actually really works out.
I wouldn't have the guts to do it, but I admire people that do.
You would have the guts.
I mean, I had sort of my virtual Paris brooding writer experience last week. We were staying in a friend of mine's apartment in Paris, and it was like... It's perfect. It's on the left bank, and you have the Roman Colosseum ruins out the window, and you're on this great French street, and I'm writing away on this book, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, I could be a really good brooding French writer, you know, for a week.
Yeah, for a week.
Yeah, then it's back to L.A.
I'll let you know. But, yeah, thank you very much. No, for you
have a good time. Well, and you really can do this stuff. That's a great thing about the modern world is you can do the show.
The only issue is it's a nine-hour difference. So,
yeah, yeah, you have to get up at a different time.
You know,
what time would it be there? What time would it be there?
It's early in the afternoon. It's the afternoon.
47 a.m.?
We're still here with our pal Flint Dilly, and you've got me and
Hola.
Daggers over there. Well, we should mention, by the way, this is the recording the show the day after Charlie has survived his first major brush with death.
I keep like glancing over at him, and he is out of it.
He's on some major sedatives right now.
He's staring out of a curtain.
But he got a cool shirt
window.
Out of the deal. But that was I saw the X-ray. That was the scariest looking thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah,
and he was basically set up and ambushed, and you know, it was attempted murder from four squirrels
in the backyard.
I mean, it was a coordinated hit. You know, they obviously channeled him into the spike. They had it all set up.
Booby
They'd been
trap.
Working on it for weeks.
They knew.
And it's time for revenge.
I think he
does have to befriend your cat.
Yeah, Julio
and get a few more cat
up.
Friends. Because cats, I think, are better equipped to deal with squirrels than dogs.
For that, yeah.
Because basically, he's got to get them scared, get them to run up in the tree, and then the cat's waiting.
Yeah.
And just take them down one at a time.
Flint has written the whole story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to write Talking Mouse movies. I mean, it's not that far from a chipmunk.
Now, did you with Fievel Goes West? Were you involved in the first film, or how did you get brought in?
No, I had nothing to do whatsoever with the first film. I met Lisa Henson at a party. It's kind of a funny story, but at a party, and she was an executive at Warner Brothers at that point. And we were talking for a long time about Achilles' Shield and the Iliad. But I'd mentioned I was an animation writer, and she said, oh yeah, we have an animated project. You ought to come pitch it. Okay, now, I'd just been doing TV shows. I only sort of knew what that meant. I mean, I was more sophisticated than that. But I went in the next day. It turned out it was at Amblin, and it was... the kid versions of Looney Tune characters, which are ended up being a thing called Tiny Toons. I wrote it as a movie. And then, you know, they had to compete. Steven came in one day and said, look, you know, I got good news and bad news for you. The bad news is we're not going to make this a movie because we got to compete with DuckTales.
Yep.
So, you know, it's going to be a TV show. But the good news is I got another movie for you.
The Goofy movie?
And that turned out to be Fievel.
But did you write the Tiny Toons...
I wrote
characters?
It as a movie. Yes. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Well, some of them. Like Babs was out of my original script. But once again, you know, Steven's movie and his property. So, you know, I think I came up with Babs only because it sounded like Bugs and I had a girl named Babs lived across the street from me when I grew up. But, you know, authorship and all that and that kind of environment is really.
That's how
it's
I
mean, dubious.
Our
I mean, you are, yeah, you, it is a collaborative thing, and everybody that comes out of the room thinks they created everything.
You know,
and that's how the human brain works. It's not that people are dishonest and duplicitous. You know, that's why, you know, Lennon and McCartney and Jagger and Richards are really smart to just say we're sharing credit, even though we all know that this song's going to be really sort of mine and this one's really sort of yours. And, you know, not until a month before you die can you talk about who wrote what. You know, it really wasn't until the last interview with John Lennon that they...
Before we started recording today, our podcast, we played you one of our songs. And it's funny, you know, since Sadie and I started working together, we've gone into this 50-50. Whoever instigates the idea, it is such a strange collaboration because you never know what that one little thing is that's going to make the
right.
song. You know, like one of us could come up with a riff or just one line. Like there was a song... Where you pulled in one of your uncle's lines, the slip and slide and the what was it?
The slick end slide and the rough end drag us away.
The slick end slide and the rough end.
Well,
drag
that was
us away.
In the song, yeah. That's how it went.
Yeah, and I just you know that to me that makes that entire song work, even though the song is 3.5 minutes long and there's a lot of
right.
But it's just that one little.
Well, that's the whole thing, you know. If the whole thing is sometimes it's one little thing that clicks it, and with something that really works, it's 10 of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, I mean, just a totally different medium. I mean, I was thinking about Sherlock Holmes the other day, and like, if he doesn't live at 221B Baker Street, is still that character? Or if he doesn't wear, has, you know, smoke the,
right,
you know, calabash
like
pipe.
What's going to stick? What does everybody remember?
Yeah, actually, because I don't buy the Lucy Liu series.
I've gotten totally sucked into it, and I understand people not buying it. But now, in season 5, I actually even like it better than the Benedict Cumberbatch English version.
Nobody beats Basil Rathbone. I just want
to. I'm totally down with you with Basil Rathbone.
It wasn't the original one on radio.
No, the original one was John Garfield or something like that. I think that was his name. But it was an actor, you know, an actor who actually, like, the Deerstalker cap came from him and all that. But Basil Rathbone was my first Sherlock Holmes.
That would have been my first tattoo, by the way. I wanted 221B on my back in giant letters.
Yeah.
How many first tattoos have you almost had?
First tattoos. Well, the one I was most serious, I almost put a piece and a fish sign on my wrist because my
good
high school girlfriend and I
didn't.
Used to say peace and fish was our thing.
Why? Like Fish the
Jesus
band?
And
we
had like a
just
Jesus
kidding.
Consciousness very young as Jews growing up in Highland Park in Northbrook, Illinois. But
I'll knock the microphone
pouring
over.
The Jack Daniels as we talk.
Yeah.
I would say the tattoo I got closest to getting would have been. Oh, I was gonna have Nothing Matters and What If It Did tattooed on me. A couple other phrases. But yeah, 221B would have been it. And then throughout my life, I always set milestones. I said if I could get I wanted to record a record at Capitol, and I said once I do that, I'm going to put the Dempsey logo on my wrist.
Yep,
and
I remember that.
And that
one.
Wasn't enough, so I needed to do something else. And I don't know. My problem is that I think once the needle touches my arm, I'm
you
gonna
should
move.
Actually. I just realized
I'm
that.
Not doing it.
All right,
you
so let's talk about your band
tattoo.
For a minute. I want to talk about your band.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, because we decided we were going to do something different, and we didn't just be talking about the old stuff. Okay. All right, now, so what you have to figure out, think about it in terms of Sherlock Holmes. What's your identity?
Exactly.
Okay? What's your regional identity? Okay, you're in a really cool part of Hollywood here. Okay? You're up on Ivar. I didn't even know Ivar did anything other than be a big urban street. I didn't know it wound up.
Well, I didn't know either until I found this place.
Yeah, okay. You're up here. You've got all this stuff around you. You got all of this is your 221B Baker Street. Okay, how do you turn that into an identity?
It's the coolest thing I've ever heard anybody say ever in this.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. Look at this place.
I live at 221 Baker Street.
Well, I mean, Sherlock Holmes didn't have guitars hanging around and all that. But, I mean, okay, I'm looking at a black and white photograph, you know, sort of.
Extra points if you know what I did to this one.
I can't see it from this.
Ooh, Spaceman Spiff knew.
It's Peter Sellers and being there looking at Groucho Marx. And on the TV, I superimposed it together.
Oh, great. So I was like, yeah, I had no idea what it was. But, you know, it's just this general impression of it is a well-framed place. The place is well-painted. It's not falling apart.
It's a very distinct
style. It's sort of like what mine would have been, you know, had my wife not come in and, you know,
I do
superimpose
have
this
Peter Pan complex.
Right.
Won't go
we got
away.
An American flag kind of serving as a curtain in the corner thing, you know, kind of, you know, half drooping down. We got a candle lit in front of a mirror and it looks kind of elegant over there. And then we got a pile of junk sitting on here. But all incrementally, every piece
that's
of junk,
junk
is interesting. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's not junk, but look how it's piled.
I got Ponderosa
okay,
playing
I don't think
cards
he sees it anymore.
From the old Bonanza show in there.
Okay, he doesn't see that anymore.
He literally buys like dice and chess sets from old film movies, like film sets at thrift stores and flea markets.
And then it's art.
Yeah, no, and it becomes art. And if you figured out how to package it, then we have this really great London 1815 stylized clock. Yeah, I mean,
that
this is a very interesting place. But,
actually,
okay.
I used to perform when I was a teenager because I went to a little art school in London when I was 15, and I would make money outside the Kensington Tube playing guitar. Playing old Maxwell Street blues songs.
And that's what's great about that is that, you know, they still have buskers, you know, all around London doing that.
Absolutely.
And how many people got discovered that? I remember Rod Stewart was literally discovered singing in the Tube station.
Was he really?
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, look at him, Long John Baldry. How's that for a really obscure rock and roll tribute?
I would like to, when we tour London, I would like to go and do a video in front of that Kensington station and play real good old-fashioned Chicago blues. Like
cool.
A Willie Dixon song or something.
Why don't you play one of your songs? Okay. See, that's the thing is there's a line between inspiration and you.
What does that mean?
It means you don't copy. You let it inspire you in your thought. 1 + 1 = 3.
I'm not following.
I know. Do you?
Yeah, well, here's what I think you're saying.
I want to understand
what you're saying. I'll tell you what I think you're saying. Is what you're saying is basically Stephen King was talking about a really interesting thing about the evolution of a writer's style. and this goes for musicians or anybody else, is he's saying if you read his early stuff, it would read like a version of H.P. Lovecraft or a version of, you know, Robert E. Howard or whoever. Then he'd read John O'Hara and a little John O'Hara would slip in there. And at a certain point, you simply become yourself. You know, and I mean, you know, it's like the Rolling Stones started out really wanting to be nothing other than the best English blues band in the world. That was their aspiration. It wasn't until
they wanted to be a Chicago blues band.
Yeah, they wanted to be a Chicago. Yeah. That's why they showed up at Chess Records, and right. You know, and it was Andrew Lou Goldham, I think, who, you know, basically said, "Okay, you guys have to start writing songs." And he ran into John Lennon and Paul McCartney at Piccadilly Circus. Now, imagine that. Took him over and said, "Okay, teach these guys how to write a song." And they wrote "I Want to Be Your Man," all four of them together, right?
Wait, what?
"I Want to Be Your Man." You'll hear there are Rolling Stones versions of that song and there's Beatles version of that song.
Wait, four of them wrote it together?
Yes, they were. I don't know whether they're all credited on it, but they were all in the room and John and Paul were showing Mick and Keith how to write a song. It didn't really take, okay? And then Oldham locked them into a kitchen, said they couldn't come out. They're like using the sink, right? You know, and they couldn't come out until they had a song. And they wrote a song that they didn't record until much later.
Called "Peeing in the Kitchen Sink."
Yeah, it's called "Kitchen Sink Pee." No, it was "As Tears Go By," and it was kind of too wimpy to really show to the rest of the band. So they gave it to Mick's girlfriend with Marianne Faithfull, who made a hit out of it before the Rolling Stones did it. But anyway, the point is that what
how did I live this long without knowing that?
How
story?
Do you keep interrupting?
Well, because I read Keith Richards' autobiography, which, by the way, is the best book about creativity I've ever read in my life.
We're big fans of Graham Nash's book, Wild Tales.
I will check that out too.
I read it because Kenny told me.
I read all.
Tells me to read the Keith Richards.
Actually, I listen to the audiobooks of these That's things. Right. You know, his thing about when it's in Keith's guitar clinic. He's talking about learning to play guitar, and if you listen to it, you would think this was some pedantic old music scholar who'd never written a thing in his life. Okay, and then you realize, no, this guy wrote, like, you know, the anthems of a generation. He's saying things like, "I don't really believe in chords anymore. You know, it's like everything's on its way to being something else. And if you think too much about some phase in between..." You know, and I realized he was
accent,
right.
Because that is a terrible British.
I thought it was pretty damn perfect.
I don't think that was British.
I thought it was.
He just sounded more.
He's more like this. And you get to the part of the disc where he's still like, "You don't know what's saying at all." Yeah,
just sure. Richard's audiobook is him falling asleep.
Well, no. What's great about the audiobook is the first six discs are an English actor reading it. The next four, Johnny Depp, and the last two are Keith Richards. And you have to listen to everybody else so you can finally get to understand him.
Seen the Muscle Shoals documentary?
No, what's that?
Really, Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where all the
That's where they recorded "Sticky Fingers." They recorded "Wild Horses,"
Aretha Franklin.
Maybe "Can't You Hear Me Knocking" or something like that. I mean just specifically to that book, because that's where Dwayne Allman was in that period. Oh, no, Muscle Shoals is one of those famous recording studios in the world. And there's some reason they weren't, in the Stones book, they weren't supposed to be there. It's like, it's some English visa reason or something. I mean, it was some...
Oh, yeah, that was when they got, was it exile?
No, that was in 1960.
Yeah, that was right before that. That's when they were hiding out in France. I mean, yeah, they're living in, you know, they're broke and they're living in an extremely swanky chateau on the coast in France. Okay, I mean, it's not a normal sense. Like, you wouldn't feel real broke.
That was the inspiration for... our first record.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so now you think about your persona that's partly based on truth and partly based on a slightly fictionalized version of yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what everybody
That's what your dream is.
Okay, but now integrate it to, like, what's really here and give it a real identity. That's what, I mean, it's just interesting that bands don't really do that anymore.
That's what I think. And almost never did.
With the what?
No, you're so good at it and you don't even realize it. It's like you don't give it credit.
I think a lot of the stuff we write and sing is very literal to what the experience is.
But now, what if the whole experience is customized to be its own thing?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, what I mean is it's like, okay, I had a friend... who plays, and this guy is one of the best game designers in the world, but he also turned out to be a really good musician. I was telling him, and he's a magician. He's also a guy that paid his way through college being a poker player. He's kind of these math geniuses, you know.
He's a mathgician?
No, he's a magician and a mathematician. So he's a mathgician.
Clever.
And, but, you know, and I was telling him, you ought to use that in your music. I mean, you know, why aren't you using all your other skills? And it's like, there's a lot of things you're interested in. You know, why aren't superheroes showing up in this? I've never figured out why there weren't more bands like Kiss. I'm not recommending you do that. But, you know.
To be frank with you, I created an alter ego called Jack Dempsey. And he was based on, I'm writing.
On the boxer?
No. Well, ironically, the boxer was born on June 24th, which is my, he was born on June 24th, which is my birthday. And my other folk hero to me was Jimmy Stewart's character, the Six Shooter. Mm-hmm. Which is an old radio drama. It's the last one CBS did. Mm-hmm. Save the Network. And I'm obsessed with that show. It was Thoreau meets Wyatt Earp is what Britt Ponsett was, the character. But I just found out that they killed the character of the Six Shooter off on June 24th. So it's a bit like Mark Twain.
And then they killed off Jimmy Stewart's radio character?
On June 24th.
I didn't even know about that, Ray, because I listen to old radio shows and I can't get to sleep at night.
Me too.
I mean, usually crime stuff.
I listen to You Bet Your Life.
What?
I listen to You Bet Your Life.
Yeah, I've got to start branching out. I mean, I just almost listen to, you know, things like, you know, Raymond Chandler and Johnny Dollar and Sam Spade.
Johnny Dollar.
And,
Johnny Dollar is what I based my music persona is based on Johnny Dollar.
Okay, now build all the way off
with
that
the character. And
you get the clothes doing that stuff. That's the album cover.
I went so far.
That's what the songs are about.
I did that. I just and it fucked me so royally. By the time I got into like a major record situation, it was
That's one of the first things.
But have
I
the
remember.
Funky phone call come in at the beginning, and then you're writing the song about the case that follows the phone call. And the other thing nobody does is in an era of singles, nobody does songs that are continuity, like the song's the serial, you know, and you have to buy the next one.
Green Day, American Idiot.
Yeah, and obviously it goes back to Tommy and stuff like that. But, you know, but I mean, imagine if like you really had to listen to the next thing to know the next part of the story.
I do think
we should do an album like that.
We have, I think the first year and a half of stuff we have, we've got about 60 songs together. And it is pretty chronological to what we were dealing with and what we're going through.
Chronological,
but what do you lay over that to make it?
Yeah.
But like I said, that's a really interesting question. I was actually going to ask you on the show now was your thoughts on branding with a music project, because you were talking about, you know, cross-platforming earlier when we started the episode. We were talking about Buck Rogers and the cross-platforms and the rocket ships and the toys and transmedia and all this kind of stuff. With Jack Dempsey, when I put out the first record, every aspect of it was fictionalized. It was based on the music that I wrote when I was a kid and based on characters I saw on Maxwell Street. It was based on Johnny Dollar. There was an episode of a Johnny Dollar episode where he comes to Chicago and he goes to Billy Goat's Tavern in my mind. And
right.
So, and he goes in looking for somebody and comes out with, you know, a bruised fist from punching out somebody at the place and whiskey on his lips. And then, you know, the next time I imagine meeting Jack Dempsey, my character that I created, he's riding to try and save Tonto, who's just been kidnapped by the Baker gang, and he's now trying to get him out of his thing.
Okay.
See,
so the first thing to do is reconstruct some of those radio shows and actually put them in the album so that context is right there. Like Roger Waters does all the time. You know, even his solo albums, all the Pink Floyd albums were all about that. You have these, like, weird, you know, things going, except you're doing it as a narrative, so we have clues as to what the song's about.
Well, The Wall is a great example.
Yeah, any Pink Floyd did that brilliant. Because that's what it's more and more about.
That band Marillion?
See, this is you, though. This is like the Dempsey stuff.
Well, but I was going to say, so what happened with me was that album cover there, if you can see it, I've got this character. I would put these white stripes down my face. I called it my Trail of Tears.
Right.
But if you know enough about old time radio, I was doing the shadow. I'm doing, you know, he's Lamont Cranston to me.
Yep.
And so even the hat is indicative of that era of pulp novels.
So okay, pulp is the coolest thing in the world.
Coolest thing in the
world. Okay, my first real trip to Comic-Con, which was just this kind of charmed experience, but what I discovered was they're selling these pulps, and then you could buy them for like $5. They're reviewed kind of as garbage. There's no collector value. So I just bought a box of them, mostly crime pulps, people would have expected me to want, you know, science fiction and all that. And no, I want, you know, I was buying The Shadow, Secret Agent X, Operator 5, Phantom Detective, all that stuff. And, you know, because I only vaguely knew about pulp, you know, I mean, I knew there was something back there and I knew The Shadow, but I could never connect up the Radio Shadow with the Maxwell Grant book Shadows. And you know, I knew there was Fu Manchu, but I knew that wasn't real pulp, and I knew about Robert E. Howard. I mean, it wasn't like I was totally ignorant, but I never like held this in my hand before. And I took him home, and a guy named Dave Marconi was living on my couch. He was a screenwriter, and he was like, he was kind of a hot writer at that point. So
what would he know?
He went on to write Enemy of the State, Live Free or Die Hard, a new movie called Collision.
Couch. I love L.A.
Oh, no, I mean, well, he's a good buddy of mine. I mean, you know, but anyway, you know, I went home and I was saying, you know, Dave, take a look at these books. I mean, is it just me or are these things really great? It's really kind of freshness we haven't seen in a long time. Well, it's incredibly talented. It's this wonderful period. And most mediums have this where you had these extraordinarily talented people, you know, all writing in what was viewed as a garbage medium. But they were, you know, classically trained people, and they're paid by the word. And so you get unbelievably high quality writers, and there's no pomposity, there's no pretense. Yeah, exactly. And what I was buying was the originals, which, you know, are like this by this, you know. And I still have a bunch of them. I mean, I'm not a collector as such, but when I see something cool, I buy it. But anyway, so bring some of that into what you're doing in the music and just lay it on top of, view it as a, yeah, there we go.
I went and got some pulp novels out of my room. I was just holding up the adventure.
Well, Arthur Conan Doyle's, he's not quite Penny Dreadful, but I mean, he was the Strand. That was like the grandfather of pulp novels.
Well, I was going to say, see, it's interesting because Sadie and I, this is an area we tend to differ on with video games and this kind of stuff. But you know,
well, no, you have your own style and your own likes, and it's very specific and it's very stylistic.
Well, but I was going to say it's so interesting because part of what I love about the Western ones,
yeah,
more than any other,
yeah, one, that's pure pulp there. Yeah,
it was so. Not only did I love the artwork on these, I'm looking at one called "The Lone Hand" by L.L. Foreman, but I just love the one
Foreman.
In this. The one line.
That's my family. Mm-hmm.
And just the way they would open, like, you know, like it's hard for me to read, some old now, but. Yeah, sure. The Foreman one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Yeah, enemy one.
Say, enemy of Pulp. Because you're young and have great eyes. We don't. Just to the opening line of this.
I make your case an exception. You will not be shot.
I mean,
yep.
What the hell? I make your case an exception. You will not be shot. How do you not want
to
go forward?
Yeah, you want to read the next line. Because that's what these guys knew. Is they had to get them to read the next line.
Instead,
they had to
you
fight
will be
for
hanged.
Every line.
Did you hear the second line?
No, what is it?
Thanks, Sava said. Instead, you will be hanged.
Country music and cowboy music and have a cookout.
All right, that is what's happening. That is the good side of what's happening in the 21st century.
People
can actually do that stuff.
Yeah.
And through networking and all that, you know, and through the internet, you can meet
share
the other
it.
200 people in the world,
right,
who think that, you know, doing an old-time Jim Bowie Western cookout is the coolest thing in the world to
have
do.
Y'all ever gone on meetup.com?
I just signed up for that today.
Are you serious?
Well, because I'm interested in a particular subject, and I was looking for a support group for it, and it was meetup.com is where it came.
It's only great in, like, bigger cities, but, yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Well, it's really funny is, okay, so we integrated. I will put Pulp and Jim Bowie and Geo Mobile Entertainment all together in one thing. So part of our story in Ingress, I'll try to keep it short, but basically we went to Robert E. Howard Days in Cross Plains, Texas, because our project lead, John Hanke, the guy that created Google Earth, but it was behind Ingress, grew up in Cross Plains, and his mother does Robert E. Howard Days every year. And so we went to Robert E. Howard Days, and and he wrote Conan, but far more interesting than Conan, you know, was our Robert E. Howard's horror stories and his westerns. Okay, right near Cross Plains, there were the San Saba Mines. These are these legendaries. There's Frank Dobry or something like that. He's a Texas historian. It's the best lost treasure story there ever was. Apparently, there were mines back there in... Yeah, do a song about it. Do a whole concept album about it. There were mines back there that the conquistadors found. Just in the middle of Texas, okay. Like Cross Plains, almost you put a dot in the middle of the square, gotcha. That would be Texas. That's where Cross Plains is. And it's not far from there. There are also weird Indian burial mounds and things like that out there.
All over the South.
My
great aunt wrote like the Bible on South American Indians.
She had the museum.
Oh, well, yeah, because there was all that stuff where they believe they basically Aztecs or Toltecs or something came up into our American South and built stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. She has a book called Sun Circles and Human Hands, and it's what every college uses as their textbook now.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. Okay. So it's this lost treasure mine. It's all these stories about somebody that found the mine. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. And they saw it was marked and described this tree. And they would come back with an artifact from it, you know, gold, you know, a big, big chunk of gold or something. But they could never find it again. Or they died going back to try to find it. But their succession. Well, the last of the people looking for it was Jim Bowie. Okay, he really went to find the San Saba mines. I think at one point he thought he'd found them.
Oh, you just brought the story back to
I'm telling you, it's going to connect all of this stuff together. So as part of our fiction, we decided that Jim Bowie actually had found the mines.
Oh.
And what, you know, and figured out, or he got a really good lead, but what he figured out is that the conquistadors, okay, when they fled the mines, what happened is they were running the mines. We know a lot of gold came out of there, and they were attacked by local Indians and beaten back, so they fled. And they fled, of course, their local mission, which was the Alamo. Okay, and that's what Jim Bowie was doing there, is he was looking for the original maps. Okay, Bowie was there looking for the original maps. Which indeed, in our story, were really there, and we wrote it like a Robert E. Howard horror story, okay? You know, because Robert E. Howard, shortly before he killed himself, went out looking for the San Saba mines, and we know that because he wrote his pen pal H.P. Lovecraft to tell him about the search for the mines.
Why don't we have pen pal names?
What do you mean? Me and you?
Oh, we do, I guess. Pistol and Dagger.
So.
So point is, you get pulp magazines, and we set this all up. We had all these geographical points that players could look for and find the stuff and all that in our game, because our game leads people around
that's
the real world.
That's so cool.
It's a real-life
treasure map.
It's this whole thing. Well, that's what you can do, is people go out and trace old trails for you and send pictures back, and you can, inside a day, trace any trail you want with, you know, hundreds of people going out and finding stuff and sending you pictures.
How fun.
And it happens in almost real time. Somebody will go to the Alamo.
So could you set it up like escape room? Like,
well, that's what we're trying to figure out, is how you do a geomobile escape room inside
an area.
Any hiking trail clues there. And before this year is over, I will do that.
So
that's dope.
First of all, thank you so much for coming on our show. And I feel like
we've really wandered around talking about it. It's probably the most incoherent show ever done by anybody for any reason.
I love this show. I've got 1,000 questions still. But I want to ask, so you've written some really popular video games. And you were saying earlier in the conversation that you were involved with Uncharted, the very first one, which was a brilliant story.
Yeah, well, Dan Airey got me into it because I had met Dan. And once again, that was from the pulp. Because what came out of that whole pulp experience is Dave Marconi and I went and wrote the Agent 13 books, which were pure 30s pulp novels. Now, when we pitched them as movies, we had to say it's James Bond meets Indiana Jones. But what we were really doing was just straight ahead
30s
pulp. That's
the best pitch
pulp.
I've ever heard, ever. James Bond meets
that
Indiana Jones.
That is a good pitch.
Well, we went and pitched
it. Did that work? Did you sell those?
It's an interesting story. So what happens is we go in there, we have like, yeah, and then the biplanes are attacking these giant Zeppelins, and, you know, the lightning guns shooting, you know, and all that, you know, in the 80s, that was really expensive Rocketeer. Movie making. Yeah. Well, and it was very much in Rocketeer country, though from completely different sources, you know, we weren't coming from serials, really, we were coming from pulps. But, I mean, we have, you know, it's happening during World War II, and you got secret societies that date back to Lemuria, and, like, there's nothing not in Agent 13. And so everybody said, well, go write the script and bring it in. We find this really interesting. We'd have to read this, which we didn't know there was a blow-off or not. But we decided, because I was a silver bullet with TSR at the time, so we decided let's do it as novels. That way, you know, we're not sitting around waiting for a studio. So we wrote three Agent 13 novels, and they were distributed. They then made them go with the Top Secret game. They were kind of the pulp expansion for the Top Secret game, and they were at Source Books and all that, so their game product. Then about
Source
4 years...
Source Books in Illinois?
What?
Source Books in Illinois?
What do you mean?
In Naperville, the company Source Books?
No, no, no. This is a company called TSR, which was the company that made Dungeons and Dragons.
What's the Source Books thing, though, you're saying?
Oh, the Source Books are in role-playing games and, like, D&D games.
Oh, there's
Source
a
Books are genre
Source books.
Books. It
out
is.
Illinois.
Yeah, no, Source Books are a generic term for books that are like a whole subgenre inside a game or a subset of adventures. And it tells you how the characters are and the locations and the themes of the stories and gives you some springboards and stuff like that. Anyway, so, and then we did them as graphic, we did Agent 13 as graphic novels about 4 years later. We never got around to writing a movie script. And then we had a year run of comic books with 13 Assassin, which was a spinoff from Agent 13. And then nothing happens for 20 years. Then it was Jason Brown, who works with Sean Daniels, went over to my agent's office, found Agent 13, loved it, and now it's set up at Universal with Charlize Theron. Now, Agent 13, and she's Agent 13. Now, in our books, Agent 13's a guy, but Charlize Theron can play whatever she wants.
Will you write the story?
No. So they've got screenwriters and all that. No, I mean, Dave and I are producers. But we're in development, and maybe you'll see an Agent 13 movie. So the point is, finding these pulps in a box led to three novels, 12 comic books, three graphic novels.
Well,
and there's audio. There's old time radio shows.
This is why I think it's so important. Like things like flea markets and that thing I was mentioning at Riley's Farm, because you never know.
That's why hipsters are so important.
But you never know where inspiration is going to come from. And I feel like there's so much rich material in what has come before. That you get, I walk by a table at a flea market, and you'll see, you know, 50 different masks from all around the world on one table, and each one of them has its own story. I find that so fascinating.
Oh yeah, I've always wanted to do a story about, it's kind of related to that, about these guys that chase down old movie props. I mean, like there's a whole subculture of people that, you know, I met one of them who was, you know, asking me about some Buck Rogers. He wanted to do some Buck Rogers thing. But he was telling me, yeah, you know, here's the story about the Starfighter. Apparently, after the show was canceled, they took the Starfighter. That was the fighter plane they flew around in Buck Rogers. And, it was just they'd thrown it in the dumpster, and a guy pulled it out. It was put on the back of a flatbed truck, and it took off, and nobody knows where it is. And so I start hearing about, like, all these different props and, you know, the famous one, like Dorothy's slippers and the Maltese Falcon and stuff like that. And I said, well, what's, like, the holy grail of lost things nobody's found? Well, that's not, I mean, they know where that is. I remember being at Lucasfilm and, like, actually seeing the whip, the hat, and the jacket sitting, you know, in sort of the bin where they put them. They're just sitting there and saying, wow. The idolies that Indiana Jones stole in the beginning. But so I said, well, what's like the holy grail? Well, and it's, okay, I may be getting this wrong, but it was something like Julie Newmar was in this show where she played a robot. And we know the costume exists, just nobody knows where it is. That would be the ultimate thing to get.
From Catwoman?
No, she played a robot in some short-lived show. I don't know what, IMDb, Julie Newmar, no. But apparently that's, you know, so there's this hierarchy of these. It's like, you know, the Holy Grail or, you know, some saint's relic of lost movie props. people are hunting for. And I'd love to do a story about that.
You have been so gracious with your time with us. And is there something that you are aspiring to do in the world of arts and entertainment that you haven't done yet? Like, do you want to do a film and direct it? Do you want to write something? Are you in the classics space, or do you want to do something that hasn't been done yet? Like, what's
you know,
left to do?
It's really funny. Yeah, I've never written an hour long live action show. I'd like to do that. I've written animated, movies. I've written live action movies. I've written, pretty much every kind of video game there is. I mean, I'm loving what I'm doing. I mean, doing GeoMobile, because like with Ingress, we've done comic books, we've done novels, we've done audiobooks. We do everything because we come out with new assets every day, and then every once in a while we have to do a big thing to tell the whole story. But our story is kind of a game that we play with our players, where we sort of give out one clue a day that connects to something old, points to something in the future, shows some of the backstory and subtext, and then has a piece of mythology in it. We try to get something out there every day for them to chew on, and they speculate, and we have
so cool.
Have you
ever tried to do a product tie-in with Ingress?
What do you mean a product tie-in?
Well, like
partner,
like partner with a project, like find a, I don't know, an area with like a music project, for example, like something creative.
Oh yeah, we did it. We have a character who the story of Ingress is that they're basically at CERN. I mean, and parts of this are true. Our rule with Ingress is that any of our fake science or stuff like that has to stand up to a three paragraph Wikipedia test. After that, it can get fictional. But pretty much everything's true. Now, there are some people who believe that that all of the stuff is true, and that we're hired to make it look like it's fiction. That Ingress is in fact a game for harvesting exotic matter for the intelligence community. And at CERN, when they found the God particle, they also found stuff called exotic matter. And what's funny about exotic matter is it basically is ordered data. That's not supposed to happen in nature. And so when you tie that into string theory and quantum mechanics, you realize something's, because basically exotic matter exists in multiple, I don't want to bore you with string theory, but basically in multiple dimensions at the same time. It's like a pixel.
That's what I was thinking whenever you first started talking about this.
Yeah.
Whenever they all evolve into one, I was like...
And so all this stuff exists in multiple dimensions, and the unknown people out there, we don't know whether they're people or they're an intelligence or what they are, but we call them the shapers because... It's matter that can go in and literally start shaping people's brains. And because of the game, we're mass harvesting exotic matter. Before that, it was very rare stuff that just leaked out of portals. And what was interesting about the portals in our world is all of our portals are like works of art and famous significant buildings and historical places. And our theory is that, and if you look at the way statues are placed, it's a little mysterious just in the real world. And that is that we intuitively feel these places, and then we go build a statue there because there's something special about the area. In other words, Stonehenge, they just felt there was something
pyramids.
Unusual happening there, and they went and built that. They didn't understand that it was because exotic matter was pouring out of those portals, and so it inspired people. It made you feel differently. It gave you visions from other dimensions, really.
That's inspiring to think about as an artist.
Yeah, that's our premise, that it's the geography that's causing the thought, not the other way around, because that's where exotic matter comes from.
So funny.
I have some amazing news. I've been very engrossed in what you're saying, but I just found out that our dear friend Scott, who is one of the co-founders of Fresh Brothers Pizza, is so delighted that you're still here on what is now our most epic podcast, and he's bringing food.
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah, pizza would be great.
My
stomach's
about to
stay on for 20 minutes for a piece of pizza.
If we can just keep this going for another 15 minutes.
Sure, I'm not in any huge hurry.
I'm going to take one quick break real quick.
That's so funny because when we were living in Houston, I remember my stepdad got so mad at me one night because my mom and I were going to move back to Alabama. We wanted to. Like, we'd wanted to move back since we left the kid, like me and my brothers. And my stepdad was like, I remember he said, you know, Sadie, it's not a place, like, you're not going to find happiness in a place. It's in, you can't find happiness where you are. Like, right. You have to make it. It's in the people. And I was like, you don't know.
Well, actually, which that's a great way for us to wrap this up.
Both too, is true. Yeah. Okay, go.
Because I have found so much happiness sitting and listening to Flint Dilly.
I'm a place.
You are. You're like an epic island of awesomeness.
You need this statue.
Well, thank you.
I have to tell you,
I'm a guy crashed out in your couch as you pour a wounded dog on the other end of the couch.
Well, look, this to me was a wonderful experience because it was such a great refresher on, like, why I love the things that I do and how it's all starting to seep into the content that I've been creating now as an adult, and you're reminding me of that. So thank you so much for coming and talking about all
this. Oh, anytime. I mean, yeah, we ought to come back sometime. We'll have a coherent one because we rambled between so many different topics.
That's what happens.
That's what happens.
Then again, maybe it's like fun for it not to be coherent.
I guess we'll find out. We'll see, you know, if you stuck around long enough, let's offer a prize to the first person that hits us up and says a keyword.
Yeah.
What's the keyword?
Code Red Mountain Dew.
Code Red Mountain Dew. If you have stuck around to the end of this podcast and you're the first person to hit us up on
anything.
Instagram, which is Pistol and Dagger. We're Pistol and Dagger on Instagram, right?
Yes.
And on Facebook, what are we?
/ Pistol and Dagger. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, everything's the same. PISTOLANDDAGGER.
Whoever gets this message first, provided you live within a 30-mile radius of the Hollywood.
No,
sign,
we'll ship it. It'll be a super secret, special, amazing surprise.
We'll come to their house and play
Code
a song.
Code Red Mountain Dew.
You want to play a song, or what do you want to say?
We can do that too.
They have to live close because I don't have a car.
Just say Code Red Mountain Dew.
We'll do something really cool. It might
be, won't regret it.
It might be giving you a golden apple.
Or Fresh Brothers Pizza for free.
Oh, by the way, I did want to mention that we do have a sponsor called Loot Crate. Do you know about Loot Crate? We talk about this a lot on our show.
What's Loot Crate?
Loot Crate is like the best. It's like having Christmas every month at your house. You pay a subscription fee. I don't know what it is, but you can use
PADS.
PADS at checkout when you sign up for this incredible thing. And every month it's themed, and you just get a box of toys and t-shirts and just the coolest themed
stuff.
Isn't
it like comic or game?
You don't know what's centered? It's a mystery box every month?
Yeah, it could be like a Walking Dead theme, or it could be a superhero. No, it's kind of a mystery. And you always get something collectible.
Okay, but it's like, okay.
Anyways, collectible. It's really cool, and Loot Crate rules, and use us to, if you're listening to this podcast, you know what Loot Crate is.
Yeah, this is true.
So, Flint, how can people follow what you're doing in your life?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm kind of like nowhere. I mean, you know, for a social media executive, I'm nowhere. I'm around on Facebook, but that page is a real mosh pit. I promised I would write a book about this one period in the 80s.
Hey, by the way.
And I make a blog out of that.
Fresh Brothers is just...
But I'm sort of findable. Just Google me.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. Scott, you're in the background. Google's say a quick hello. Here. He just brought pizza at the end of our
Yeah, we just
podcast.
Had pizza show up, so we're out of here.
So where can they find you?
Google.
Yeah, just anywhere. Find me Facebook or... Yeah, that's you. I'm on G+.
Okay.
But I don't do Twitter. I didn't like entirely get Twitter.
Right?
I had a friend of mine who was like a Twitter genius. Like... Spend an hour trying to explain it to me, and it's like, oh, okay.
I just like to see stuff.
Well, and Sadie, they can find us at pistolanddagger.us. What if they want to find you?
I'm at Sadie May. That is S80, like 80 the number. S80MAY on Twitter and Instagram.
And I'm at Get Jack Dempsey, and we are Pistol and Dagger, and you have been listening to the Pistol and Dagger Society presented by Meltdown Comics.
Roll Tide and good night.